This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Longer unemployment lines.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Renita Jablonski. The Labor Department says this morning new jobless claims were up way more than expected last week. The number of laid-off workers signing up for benefits hit 626,000. Analysts expected something more along the lines of 580,000. We're at the highest level now since October 1982. Of course, the workforce has grown by about half since then. The Obama administration is still hoping to get people to work with programs included in the massive stimulus package, and the Senate is still adding to the plan. It's totaling something like $920 billion right now. Last night, Senate Republicans passed an amendment for a tax break on home purchases. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
If you're thinking about buying a house as a primary residence, how about this for a sweetener? A tax credit of up to $15,000. The Senate passed that amendment by unanimous voice vote last night. It would replace the current subsidy, which is $7,500 and only for first-time homebuyers. James Angel is a finance professor at Georgetown. He says the tax perk is aimed at folks in the middle class who are on the knife's edge of being able to afford the down payment on a mortgage.
By putting this $15,000 subsidy onto every home purchase, you're going to stimulate home sales. And this pickup in activity may help the market turn around.
If approved, the new tax break would expire in 1 year. It would cost $19 billion. That would balloon the total stimulus to $920 billion.
This will help the people who want to buy or sell a house this year and the realtors. The rest of us are going to pay for it.
A Senate vote on the stimulus package could come as early as tonight. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
So far on Wall Street, the Dow is down almost 1%, down 77 points to 7,879. The NASDAQ also down about 1%. The S&P 500 down 1%, just over 1%. European markets are still in the red as well. The Bank of England today took its key interest rate down to a record low 1%. Walmart is pretty much in its own category when it comes to retail reports this morning. The company saw sales go up more than 2% last month. As Ashley Multite reports, most retailers are still hurting.
January was full of big sales. It was also full of job losses. Stephen Platt runs the Platt Retail Institute in Chicago. He says vicious winter storms didn't help retailers either.
Weather is a big factor. You start factoring that in, you start factoring the state of the economy, the earnings are going to be very disappointing.
Platt says far fewer shoppers tramped through stores than retailers had hoped. Retail analyst John Morris says stores are steeling themselves for a quiet spring, in part because of their own efforts to lure customers with huge markdowns.
The big concern on retailers' minds is what kind of an impact this promotional activity has had on the psyche of the consumer. 80% off is the new 60% off.
He says if the consumer is now hooked on bargains, stores will face tough conditions for the rest of the year. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
You're listening to The Morning Report for Thursday, February 5th on Marketplace.org. America's foreign trade partners breathed a sigh of relief overnight. The Senate watered down the controversial Buy America provision in that stimulus bill. The provision had triggered fears of a trade war. The new language promises Washington will comply with international trade agreements. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Foreign companies smell opportunity in the stimulus bill. Take green power. The bill, if it passes, would bring $150 billion into clean energy. And China has nurtured this sector for years to clean up polluted skies. Beijing attorney Lester Ross says one of the most advanced industries is solar panels.
There's been a great deal of investment here in China. And China, of course, has a number of advantages in terms of costs. So China has become quite competitive in this regard, and a number of Chinese companies have attracted foreign capital to help them to grow faster.
U.S. infrastructure projects would draw Chinese bidders, too. Everything from steel suppliers to drywall to copper wiring. The Buy America clause remains in the House bill, so foreign governments in Europe and Japan continue to lobby Congress. Beijing has been more muted. But an official at the Commerce Ministry tells us that China is negotiating behind the scenes. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This morning, the Senate Banking Committee will sit down with the three people in Washington who are supposed to be keeping tabs on the Treasury Department's troubled asset relief program. Marketplace's Steve Henn has that.
When Congress handed out hundreds of billions of dollars to banks, it was careful to set up plenty of independent overseers. TARP has its own congressional oversight panel, its own special inspector general, and the Government Accountability Office also makes periodic reports. But Daniel Bryan at the Project for Government Oversight says all these watchdogs may not be looking in all the right places.
The other part in terms of oversight that worries us a lot is the role of the Fed.
So far, the Fed's extended roughly $1.2 trillion in emergency loans to banks, but very little is known about these deals or potential conflicts of interest.
The Fed's culture is to be pretty disdainful of oversight. So I think that is just a huge problem that the Congress is going to have to tackle.
And next week, when the Obama administration unveils its plans for the next phase in the banking bailout, it's likely the Fed will play an even bigger role. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The U.S. agency that manages Alaska's Arctic waters will take an historic vote today. Global warming is rapidly melting the ice off the north coast of that state, creating a tempting new playground for commercial fishing. But as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports from our sustainability desk, federal fishery managers are stopping it before it starts.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council is expected to recommend closing almost 200,000 square miles of U.S. ocean to industrial fishing. That's an area larger than the state of California, right off Alaska's northern coast. Sea ice there has been melting much faster than expected, and scientists don't know what damage huge fishing trawlers might inflict. Marine conservationist Christopher Kren says putting a hold on fishing those waters is like a preemptive strike.
And we're hopeful that other industries will look at this approach as a way to sustainably manage the expansion of industrialization into the Arctic.
Krenz is referring to potential undersea oil and gas exploration. The Pew Environment Group says if the Secretary of Commerce approves this fishing closure, it'll signify the first major effort by the U.S. to protect the Arctic marine ecosystem. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
This week, a retired schoolteacher in Cleveland left $2 million to her alma mater, Baldwin Wallace College. The 1936 graduate never married and never earned more than $40,000 a year. It's the kind of help every university could use right now during these tough economic times. And it's exactly what one university in Australia was thinking when it invited a group from Yale to come on down under and give pointers on harnessing an untapped resource, alumni. Naomi Lewin reports.
If you can't beat them, join them. At least that's what Ian Chubb would love to do. He's the head of Australian National University, the country's premier research institution. Over bacon and eggs at the ANU campus in Canberra, Chubb laughed about his money situation.
We have an endowment of around about $150 million. It's a micro fraction of what the big American universities have.
For instance, Yale University has an endowment of $17 billion.
We will never get anywhere like the U.S. system because the Australian attitude is the government provides.
And he's not kidding. At a reception, I met ANU grad John Goss. Goss loves his alma mater, but it's not on his list of worthy causes.
I pay my taxes, and it is from my taxes that the university should be funded.
Mark Dahlhopf is director of the Association of Yale Alumni. He knows without an emotional investment, people won't give.
If we don't connect them with their head and with their heart, you're not going to connect them with the pocketbook.
So Dahlhopf brought 36 Yale alumni to Australia to talk about why they give and projects they've started. ANU is just beginning to keep track of its alumni, something Yale is notorious for. CNN anchor Anderson Cooper, who's a Yale alum, once joked that if Osama bin Laden had gone to Yale, the Alumni Association would know exactly which cave he was in.
The most important thing that the Yalies can teach us in Australia is to think big in giving back to our universities.
That's Michael Kirby, a justice on Australia's Supreme Court. He spoke about an annual conference he attends that's funded by a Yale Law School alumnus. When Kirby described the influence that conference has had on major international legal decisions, it really resonated with ANU alumni. Even skeptic John Goss.
Yes, I would consider donating small amounts of money to such a special project.
Australian National University is now starting several alumni programs inspired by the visiting Yalies. They hope the money will follow. In Canberra, Australia, I'm Naomi Lewin for Marketplace.
With all this talk about a stimulus package, there seems to be a new fascination with the New Deal. Our economics correspondent Chris Farrell is with us now. Chris, some recent op-eds say the New Deal made the Great Depression worse. What's your take?
Well, my take on it is the New Deal was a success. And you have to be a little bit careful about defining that and not setting up a straw man. The New Deal was not perfect. It didn't, solve everything. But remember, we had 25% unemployment and actually really higher than that if you include the underemployed. And the New Deal basically did bring people back to work.
Now, a big part of the New Deal was stimulating wages. And you have those that say, great, wages were high. That was supposed to increase purchasing power. But really what happened was they were so high that industry ended up being choked.
Yeah. And there, you know, in defending the New Deal, I mean, remember some of the things that were done. We had Social Security. We got the FDIC. You got the Securities and Exchange Commission. We went for some higher wages to try and help out the factory worker. Not everything worked. Not everything was perfect. And real wages were going up anyway. I mean, if you had a job, I mean, think about it. If you had a job and you're getting a regular paycheck, just think how much farther your dollar went during the Great Depression because of falling prices, right? I mean, that's one aspect of looking at a deflation that goes along with the Depression.
When it comes to Wall Street, I guess a difference in the 1930s was that you didn't see images of green and red arrows for the Dow and the S&P everywhere
right.
you turned. And the Dow didn't actually hit that level that it was at in 1929 until, I think, the mid-50s.
Right, 1954.
What kind of parallel can you draw there as people really are still so nervous about what the market's doing right now?
Well, you know, one of the things that happened during the Great Depression is you get the decline in 1929, then you get the decline in 1930, and then you get a decline in 1931, and people are going, well, it can't go any lower. 6 months later, you were completely wiped out mm-hmm. because the Dow went down 89% and did not hit its low until July 1932. Parallel I would draw is the history of financial crises is that they're longer and they are deeper and they're harder to get out of than we're thinking about right now.
Well, New Deal, stimulus package, whatever you want to call things right now, how about leaving us with some new hope?
Well, I think that, you know, it's very clear that the package that gets passed, the New Deal, whatever you want to call it, let's just call it a fiscal stimulus package. It's the right thing to do. It's an insurance policy. And monetary policy is doing what it can. It now needs some help on the fiscal side.
And that is our economics correspondent, Chris Farrell. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you.
You can share your thoughts at marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Renita Jablonski. Thanks for listening. Have a good Thursday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.